Ohio Trail, Stephen Eckstein versus Midwest Prize, Mr. Eckstein.
It's just silly. The comments he makes demonstrates that he didn't read the other
media. The central question, as I understand this case, is whether any time the trial court may not release a landowner from the closure order that was found to be necessary under the nuisance action. And not all the landowners will make a petition to the trial court to seek a release from the closure order, but once that closure order is sought to be released, then the question is what standard, if any, of review or standard should a trial court apply when it is presented with that fact. In this case, Mr. Murray's clients were found to be in violation of Ohio nuisance law. The court ordered the statutory remedies. They sought release from the trial court's closure order, and the trial court denied their request. The trial court denied their request, not because they didn't pay the tax, not because they didn't put up the bond, but because they failed to convince the trial court of the good faith of the landowner that they would abate the nuisance. I don't believe there's any contention at all that the order of the trial court was overbroad and that it sought to prohibit them from disseminating other items that have not been declared to be obscene, which is often an illness, if you will, in these cases. But in this case, we have factually narrowed the issue down to whether the trial court had any leeway whatsoever to deny release from the closure order.
Counselor, given what you've presented to us in your brief, could anybody seeking release from the closure order ever satisfy the standard that you're asking for? Does it say absolutely that the, is your position absolutely the trial court, if the trial court says no, you haven't made a good faith effort, according to your brief to me, it's over?
Well, there certainly is the appeal process, and I think there's an appeal of right, and you have to satisfy the appellate court that you've lived up to, the trial court has lived up to its obligation to apply the law fairly. The question really becomes, what standard is there, if any, that would be applicable? Obviously, we don't have a standard that I'm aware of, and I proposed one, which is abuse of discretion. Certainly, that standard could be changed to anything else that you find to be acceptable. But right now, we don't have one that's there. Now,
but isn't good faith such a subjective kind of term? I mean, you know, what is your what's your good faith may not be mine. And isn't that why 376704 is written the way it's written? Shouldn't there be some way for people to get their property out of this mess?
And I don't say that there isn't. I'm only saying that the requirement that it be mandatory on the trial court to release money in all circumstances is just as obviously incorrect. You have to have some standard of life. Let me ask you this, John. What would you say if they posted a tax? They didn't pay $300. What if they put $299?
The difference in this procedure is I ask the questions. But I'll be happy to answer. The answer is you draw a sensible line.
Well, obviously. And that's what we're asking the court.
But your brief seems to indicate that if the trial judge says no good faith, it's over. Now, if you want to say a reasonable standard or subject to appellate review, you know, it's a pretty hard, high standard for us to say a trial judge abused his or her discretion.
That's obviously a very high standard. I agree.
So what's the sense of having the statute then?
I wouldn't disagree that seems to be what the appellate say. And that seems to be what has come out of Ewing's since it was issued. That Ewing seems to say it's mandatory. And obviously, it's been a number of years since that happened. And it seems equally as obvious that not many people utilize the statute to get to the result and of abating nuisances in this area. Now, that could be that I'm just simply incorrect in my assumption that there is not a due to trial. it could just, I don't believe that to be true. I don't believe it's been determined. Now, the Tenth, the appellate level, just as equally said the same thing. They didn't see that this court had ever ruled that it was mandatory. They only said you have to make a demonstration. What does the word demonstration mean? Does it mean that they simply file the affidavit with their motion? That was positive at one time. That they simply go ahead and make their motion, and if they have an affidavit attached, there's no need for a hearing. Just let them out. Because there is no lack. I say here, that seems to be a little bit more extreme than what process we've seen in the past. But equally as well, what if you go to the trial court and you put a convicted felon on who is convinced, whose honesty can legally and presidentially be challenged, and says that he'll do what the court ordered, and yet he has no position in the corporation to include the policy?
Okay, one last question then.
Yes.
You say that we can correct all that on appeal. Why can't you release the property if they violate their order, if they violate this convicted felon's word, you've given it the worst case scenario? Obviously, the people that testified here weren't convicted felons. The people owned the property, the lady did. But in any event, she testifies, yeah, we're not going to do it anymore. We're not going to let it be done anymore. If they do it again, can't you then just bring your action and close them up for good? Maybe you'd even have a position for contempt.
I agree. And for sure of the property value and any other remedies is there.
And you know
what's the difference between this and a felony drug abuse case where you close the property for a year? And yet you seem to not quibble that they could close that property for a year and the release can be denied. I think that there's no substantial difference. Is there a difference between a nuisance action you come forward? And I think that's the issue that really comes down to it when you get in there. Is there a substantial difference? Why do you call this private restraint? Where if I get a health hazard in a video arcade in Fayette County and they close that for a year, there's no First Amendment implication. The same books and the same videos that would have been sold are going to be shown in the video arcade. And yet, when we close that, we don't have a problem. Over here, where the source of the nuisance happens to be some videotapes, then when we go over to the First Amendment question or the prior restraint question, we get all we need. I see no difference. I mean, I don't think there is any. I don't think any legal distinction can be made because you can't accept that there's a rebuttable presumption that since the source of the nuisance is expressive activity, or not even that, obviously not expressive activity, but that then leads to some presumption on State Park. That never been said either. Neither of those positions, well, that position has never been said. And I think that's just a good one as well. I mean, I'm willing to live with that if someone would say that, but it's never been said. Constitutionally, the Supreme Court of the United States had never said that it's a political problem. In certain circumstances, they said that there's a high burden. But the high burden at least gives you burden. At least, I mean, beyond reasonable doubt, high burden you know, at least gives you some way to prove my case. And here, it would seem that we're saying that there is no way whatsoever at all. You simply must demonstrate. Demonstration means it appears that we just have to go into court and ask. And demonstrate would be an affidavit. I think that's important. Now, if the reason for discretion is too high, something else can be done. I don't know what that would be. I don't know if abuse of discretion
fits for you.
Great part.
Fits for you.
Well, I'm an advocate, certainly does. But by the same token, if there's another standard that is fair, then there it is. But if the standard is zero, I find that to be unfair.
Here, the Court of Appeals doesn't appear to have really even examined that issue. It seems that the Court of Appeals just found that the good faith element in the requirement for a order to allow it to stay open is a right there flies in the face of the First Amendment, and so there was no examination of whether or not this court, if good faith could be inquired into, whether or not there was an abuse of discretion or any other sort of standard. So we aren't even talking about that here in this case, are we?
Well, only if you find that Ewing really doesn't demand on mere demonstration that it be released. If you say, yes, it can be.
It's the next step, because it's not examined in this by this Court of Appeals?
No, they found that Ewing was just unable to be circumvented, and you had to release it on the Democrats.
Period, right.
Yeah, period. So I'd like to take some time before we're voting.
Yeah, let me just ask you before we sit down. Is this case moot? April 6th apparently was the date when all this came to an end.
Well, mootness was even brief and brief. My thought is this, except for the mootness doctrine, which I've been pushing all out here just as soon as I finish up, and I don't think it's, I think there's an exception to the mootness doctrine that would be helpful. Because if you say it's moot, then you're going to come, this case will come back again, and you accepted this case, and whether you wish to decide the issue or not, the question will be for the future. Sometimes.
So
moot, I don't think it's moot,
or if you could say it's moot, it's an exception. Thank you. Mr. Murray. Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I do rise on behalf of the appellees and cross appellants. Your Honor, yes, this case, insofar as the prosecutor's appeal is concerned, is moot, and we filed a motion to dismiss last week on April 6th, because what happened is the one-year closure order was affirmed by the Court of Appeals, as were all the other remedies, but the Court of Appeals held that it was error, reversible error, not to grant the release from the closure order, and so the Court of Appeals granted the release from the closure order. That order went on April 6th, 1998, and from that point, and the mandate issued, and nobody saw a say of the Court of Appeals appeal. And so the one-year closure order and the one-year release from the closure order began to go on April 6, 1997, 1998, and they both expired last week on April 6th. Now, this is not a situation which is capable of repetition and yet evasive of review, because all Mr. Eckstein had to do, it's one of two things: either move this court for expedited review of the case so that a decision would be rendered in the case before April 6, 1999, or even more simply file a motion to stay the mandate of the Court of Appeals.
Exception to the mootness doctrine, that's not an exception to the mootness. Mootness exception is that the issue is likely to, it's mootness to these parties, but the issue is one that's likely to occur again. The court keeps the issue and decides the issue to give advice to those who need the advice. Doesn't this case involve an issue that's likely to arise again?
Well, my understanding of the standard is capable of repetition yet evasive of review.
Yeah, and that's right.
And it seems to me that the evasive of review component isn't satisfied here, because as you pointed out only 2 weeks ago in State Xrel Bona versus Orange, in dismissing an election contest for mootness because the appellant didn't act diligently enough to move for expedited review or do other things that would have gotten this court's ruling before the election occurred.
Those are two different doctrines, counsel. We have special doctrines for election cases that require them to be brought timely for obvious reasons, that the ballots have to be prepared. But the Chief Justice's point is that this is for the world at large, not whether or not the waiver by your clients, and you know that seems to be by the other side, it seems to be your argument, but wouldn't it be important for this statute to be construed, the good faith element of this statute? It will be, it could evade review for a long time, for the same reason this one did, albeit you want to say that this particular, the state could have moved in some way to preserve it better. But that's not our. But that's one issue, and the next one is, but should it be decided anyway because it's capable of repetition?
I appreciate that, Justice Cook, and let me move on to the merits now.
Yeah.
We do submit this move, but we're equally confident that on the merits, what happened here in the Court of Appeals was absolutely correct.
Let's try the mootness thing just one more time, a different way, because it bothered me as I read your motion and I thought about it. If it's moot, whatever order we put on doesn't affect you anyway, does it?
That's correct.
Then why are you here?
Well, we have a cross appeal.
Okay.
That we think is not moot because there's a permanent injunction in effect, there's a $300 tax, there's a confiscation of personal property, and so we think the entire nuisance finding should be reversed. But we're here on in response to both his appeal and in support of our cross appeal.
But in your motion, you don't argue to keep the cross appeal alive, do you? You say, accordingly, this court should dismiss appellant's appeal as moot, and if the appeal goes, the cross appeal goes unless you preserve it.
Well, we didn't move to dismiss the cross appeal, so we
moved it.
Only moved to dismiss his appeal, and we obviously wanted to go forward on the cross appeal, but perhaps we should have made that more stress. On the merits of the closure order and release issue, Ewing is unambiguous and it's clear. Syllabus 5 specifically says that if you meet three requirements, the trial court must release the property from the closure order because otherwise the statute would be rendered unconstitutional under the First Amendment. So it was a decision this court rendered to avoid constitutional infirmity of the statute. So the syllabus is unambiguous. You pay the bond, $100,000. We're talking about the fact, by the way, that if they didn't abide by their promise, they would lose $100,000 in cash. That's what we're talking about. They post that, pay the cross, and demonstrate by affidavit and testimony that those particular videotapes have been out of the store from the moment the nuisance action was filed, and they will remain out of the store on into the night. What happened in the trial court is that the trial court said, in the face of that, I'm not going to follow Ewing. I don't think Ewing has any application to this particular proceeding. That was the error of law committed by the trial court. That's why the Court of Appeals reversed. In fact, if you look at the supplement to the briefs at pages 20 to 26, it's all laid out in the transcript, which is transcript pages 56 to 62 of the March 7, 1997 hearing. The trial court made it abundantly clear that it doesn't think Ewing should apply to a nuisance action predicated upon repeated violations of the obscenity statute as distinguished from Ewing, he said, which involved obscene films. Well, there is no logical basis upon which to distinguish Ewing. And the trial court was simply in error as a matter of law in rejecting the release motion predicated upon its determination that it would not follow the Ewing case. In fact, the court expressly said, after telling us why it didn't think Ewing applied, the court said, if I'm incorrect, I'm sure the Court of Appeals will review it and let me know otherwise. That's precisely what they did. They reviewed it and they said, you're wrong, trial court. Ewing is unambiguous, syllabus 5 is binding on all the courts, and it applies, and yes, it was error for you to decide that Ewing and its release provisions would not apply. So that determination is unassailable because they don't ask your honors to revisit Ewing. They don't ask you to overrule Ewing. They don't ask you to distinguish Ewing. They don't support the trial court's judgment that Ewing is inapplicable. Instead, they want to make an argument that Ewing does apply, and yet somehow the trial court should be affirmed, despite the fact that the error the Court of Appeals initially found was that the trial court was wrong not to follow Ewing.
Do you read good faith language into that syllabus paragraph 5 in Ewing?
I think what syllabus 5 does is tell us what the objective criteria is for good faith. That is what they're saying. The court said, look, I mean, good faith is such a subjective, all-encompassing standard that can mean anything to anybody, and particularly in a First Amendment context where you're talking about the possibility of closing a speech business for a year, which raises all kinds of issues of prior restraint. They said, as I read it, that we're going to interpret the term good faith in this setting to mean that if you satisfy these three objective criteria, you have satisfied the statutory requirement, whatever you want to call it. And that's my reading of Ewing. And I think, Your Honor, that that's what the Court of Appeals has simply said in this case, is that Ewing laid out the objective criteria by which the statutory standard is to be satisfied in a First Amendment case.
That doesn't seem to me to be what they said, though. The Court of Appeals seems to reason that they say in this context, common law supersedes the statute. It seemed to me, said, well, the statutes doesn't apply here.
You're right, Justice Cook. Their reading of Syllabus 5 might be slightly different than mine, but the result is the same. Whether Syllabus 5 is called common law, which supplants the statute, or whether Syllabus 5, as I'm suggesting, is really simply this court's description of what is meant by good faith for purposes of this proceeding. Either way, Syllabus 5 is the binding rule of law here, and the Court of Appeals was correct in finding that the trial court was in error for not following Syllabus 5 of Ewing.
But the Court of Appeals seemed to me to say, we don't do good faith. It's just not in the picture here. Even though it's in the statute.
Ewing supplants good faith.
Right.
You might just as easily conclude that Ewing tells us what good faith is. I don't think that's a difference that is meaningful here, because both of those outcomes are the same. Either Syllabus 5 is telling us what good faith means, or Syllabus 5 is the constitutionally imposed requirement as a substitute for an otherwise vague and impermissible standard when First Amendment is preserved at stake, which would be good.
What do you believe that the trial court takes into consideration when they're going to release this business?
Whether the property owners are prepared and the property owners must come into court as they did here and say we'll pay the cost of the action, we'll put up a bond and the full value of the property, and hire an appraiser and put on an appraisal and establish that the value of the property was $100,000 and tender $100,000 in cash. And they provided by affidavit and testimony assurances that the particular videotapes had long been removed from the store, long before we got to this point. As soon as the complaint had been filed, they were removed from the store, and they would not ever be returned to the store upon pain of losing $100,000 in cash.
And you're contending that is sufficient.
Yes.
That the trial judge has no discretion to determine, based upon those affidavits and testimony, that he doesn't believe these people who are saying we are never going to show these films again.
Well, I don't think the judge said he didn't believe these people in this case.
Well, maybe
he said Ewing doesn't apply, and therefore I'm not satisfied with good faith. And he kind of suggested that they needed to be innocent. And
I think what, in my opinion, of what Ewing is talking about is good faith when they say that they have to make a showing that they're not going to show these particular films. I think that that's what we're talking about, is good faith.
I think so.
What I'm getting to is, do you, under those circumstances, think the trial judge has any discretion, or just merely upon the showing of the debt in this case, the trial judge has no choice but to release the...
When the showing is uncontroverted, and when the evidence is unrebutted, and when there's no counter evidence by the other side that suggests that there's any basis upon which to discredit the factual assertions that are being made, then it seems to me there's only one conclusion that is reasonably possible under the facts and circumstances. If they brought in a witness, for example, hypothetically, I suppose, that said, you know, I was with all those witnesses last night who just testified, and they winked at me and they said, we've got the movie in the back room and we're actually going to play it tomorrow, then okay. But we have unrebutted, uncontroverted, overwhelming evidence, uncontested, on pain of losing $100,000. It's just unthinkable that the evidence has been worn out. It's been 2 years since this $100,000 has been posted, and no incident has occurred, not a single complaint that they've done anything other than apply completely and totally by this injunction. We're 2 years down the road, proven, and the proof was by their conduct even leading up to the application for release. So,
you think in the application for release that we are talking about specific material, let's call it XYZ film that is held obscene.
Yes.
We say we will not show XYZ or sell XYZ film again.
Yes.
Can you show ABC film, which is just as bad, but not XYZ?
Well,
and isn't that our problem?
It isn't just as bad. As a matter of law, A, B, and C are presumed to be protected by the First Amendment unless somebody proves...
Until we go through all the procedures again.
The whole point of viewing is that if you're going to close down premises in order to censor all the other movies that have never been declared obscene because the judge doesn't like the content of the other movies, that is a blatant violation of the First Amendment, and that's why Ewing said you couldn't possibly sustain the statute if that were its interpretation. And that's why Ewing said the nuisance has to be limited solely to the particular film or tapes that were finding the obscene. Otherwise, it would be censorship, and the statute would have to be struck down as unconstitutional, and that was a result that the court wanted to avoid by interpreting the statute in a First Amendment setting.
What is the procedure to address Justice Douglas's underlying question, which is fundamental to all of this? If it's drugs, continued sale of drugs would allow continued closure. If it were prostitution, continued carrying on prostitution, that here, say, as long as those specific films aren't shown, but what if other obscene films are shown? What's the procedure there? Does the prosecutor come in,
and do it all
get
over
those
again.
Films ready, right. Second, and fourth determination?
That's why you live in this country.
And then just keep getting a closure order
based off the pay for freedom.
Or these films, or even prosecute criminal.
Well, Nikita, these cases all just don't be dragging off the street.
The one that I'm reading attached to the brief. Now,
on the application. However, the court is not satisfied with the good faith of the owner that the premises not be used. Yeah. What was it that caused them to not be satisfied? They put them a $100,000 bond. They said the films, the tapes, whatever they were gone. Was there any evidence to suggest anything different than that?
May I say that my reading of the statute is good faith only applies to the demonstration that they won't violate the injunction. It doesn't apply to closing the month nor to paying the tax. Those can be, I guess, factors to consider about that, but they're not really to be weighed. And the weighing is on the demonstration.
What evidence was there then that they would not comply with their promise, that representation to the court, that this was going to occur again?
Well, I find it interesting that he said that they can, that in this matter there's uncontroverted witnesses, there's uncontroverted this, that, and the other thing. However, that kind of begs the question, because the question is, can you ever find that good faith has not been shown? If he wants controversy, I can give her whatever the word is, I can give it to him. If he wants another way to do it, another standard,
well,
I can do it.
Did you do it in this case?
Yes, I did. I impeached his witnesses. You say the landowner leases the property to a corporation. The landowner comes in and says that she is able to give the court assurances that those movies won't be shown. However, she can't say why she's in control of the corporation. The corporation has got several shareholders. No officer of the corporation came to the courtroom, only a shareholder who gave the assurances. And the shareholder who gave assurances was a convicted felon for income tax evasion. So that's the impeachment tool. So their evidence, while maybe uncontroverted in the sight of other witnesses coming forth, certainly wasn't unchallenged.
Did you offer any evidence from any witness that these particular films had been shown at any time in the
Yeah. Now, shown is not the right word because this is sale. This is a sale.
Where does the $100,000 bond requirement come from?
That's the fair market value of property.
And where do we get that? I mean, where's the requirement, though? It's from the statute.
Yes.
Why would the General Assembly put anything about a fair market value of the property, the appraisal, in this case $100,000, if the criteria was good faith showing? Why would they put any criteria at all for release? They would just say it's good faith or no good faith. But they got to put it there for some reason, didn't they?
I think.
And is that to facilitate a foreclosure, to release from foreclosure or from closure?
Which I think is required. And I think that's what you intend. You have to have a release mechanism. I'm just agreeing with that. You have a release mechanism. What is the standard to apply to the release mechanism? Is it that it must be released, or is it that it shall be released upon showing?
So,
and if you say showing, then tell me what I'm saying.
So a conclusory statement by a trial court overcomes the conditions of the statute. Judge just said, I don't think it's in good faith.
Certainly, there's transcript evidence to support the finding.
But the evidence to which you referred is this legal. The shareholder came and that sort of thing. That's the evidence.
That's what we say, is that there is no requirement.
Wasn't somebody who came, I guess your point is, there wasn't somebody who came who operated the store, who had control over the daily operation of the store, who testified, or what?
A policymaker that would come in the president of the corporation, somebody who could to give the assurance of that mechanism. I mean, those are not inconsequential matters. I mean, certainly there are factors to the thing. And I think that's what we said. Now, I certainly could have, I mean, put on the federal district court clerk and got a certified copy of the prior entry of conviction, but he admitted it on the stand.
It seems to me that that path of evidence is simply that these owners and operators are sleazy people. That doesn't go to the question, which is whether or not this material is going to offer for second at any time after using the and that's a question. And we were searching for at least one of that question controversy.
put on us. There was no challenge by a different appraiser challenge property. There was cross-examination. There was request, which, if I may, gets to the question of whether there can be any time when a court may deny the release. If you say that there cannot be, then let them put an affidavit in with their motion and issue the order without hearing. Why not do that? It would be the same thing. So now, if that should be that this case is not a case for release, which I don't see, I think it has every nobility for a trial court to find, but you don't, there's no standard to tell us what we should have done. I mean, what should I have done to do different in this matter? It's Ewing. Ewing doesn't tell you anything, except Ewing, which was the court's effort to make that statute constitutional. And Ewing, by the way, was dismissed on appeal. No substantial federal constitutional question by the Supreme Court. Doesn't necessarily say that you can't ever deny the cloak. It says it must be released upon the following, which we agree with. I don't think I'm challenging it. I say Ewing doesn't say what we think it is. And that's what we're saying here today as well. It doesn't say what we say. But what does it mean? It says in the body of good faith that. A good faith showing. It incorporates good faith showing of the statute, and yet when the syllabus was that, the most demonstration part. I don't know the word demonstration. It's the same thing with here, conviction and violation. It took me a while to see the difference between a conviction and a violation. And when I found that violation didn't mean conviction, I was happy because it didn't make me have to go through those prosecutorial steps to get to a conviction in order to come back and do what the prior conviction. You know, or what I could have done, I think that's an issue. Well, what throws, I'm not saying these people are sleeping, because I would never say that. And I agree with Mr. Murray that there's constitutional protected material because it has not been prosecuted. That doesn't mean that it's not obscene. It just means that it hasn't been prosecuted and we let it be obscene. I agree with you that when you stand up there and you look at 1,000 videotapes for sale, and I've got the prosecutors do it, they're one of them, some of them 6 hours long, it takes a week to do one case. Now I've got 1,000 weeks worth of work. There is no logic to this process that we've established. And I'm saying that to you because you went back in 1975, which was a movie, which was a huge, role, and they had, get on from distributors, and they had huge amounts of equipment, and they could only show one at a time.
You're running out of time, Mr. Eckstein.
Am I out, Doctor?
You're out there.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinions.